This is what they mean when they say they don't make movies like this anymore. Something for thinking people to observe, seeing behind doors that you're, not meant to know what's going on, that sense of intrigue and skullduggery and, backroom deals and things like that. All that stuff is great. Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we're going to talk today about Conclave and about We Live in Time, starting with Conclave. Okay, Mike, I remember back in 2011, you and I showed a movie called We Have a Pope at our International Film Festival. And when this movie came out, I thought, wow, this is going to be so much like that movie. And it kind of was and kind of wasn't.
Habemus papam. We're going to use some Latin. We're going to use some Latin today. Actually, the timing on that was coincidental, but it was so serendipitous. I remember that. And the audience just couldn't quite believe it that we had these prophetic powers. And I did nothing to dissuade them. But anyway, yeah, the papal politics is as intrigue ridden, as Byzantine as any politics. The two films otherwise are quite different. You're right. I think with Conclave, as we speak, it's getting a lot of media buzz. A lot of people have mentioned it to me who otherwise, not that they don't mention other movies to me, but that's like, front and center, something they ask me about or they tell me their reaction or anything of that sort. So I kind of gauge the public interest that way. Commercially, as we speak, it's been doing well for, a relatively small film. And so, all that by way of a quick preface for, again, as we speak, because, we have these archives and who knows when somebody will listen to it and say, he was so wrong about that. But as we speak, last time I say that, I am hoping that Ralph Fiennes is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor. And I'm hoping that Isabella Rossellini is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress. So let me get my pitch in there. I'm not a voting member, but I can say that on my own terms. The thing that needs to be said immediately about Conclave is to look at the title itself. And I was only half joking when I mentioned Latin before, because the word conclave, coming from the Latin, means a room that can be locked. And this is a crucial visual as well as thematic motif in the film itself. It's not coincidental from a filmmaking perspective that the Vatican has a lot of oversized doors, and that when you're a cardinal inside the Sistine Chapel and you're voting, and of course it is in complete secrecy, that yes, even they have their phones taken away, they're really just meeting with themselves. And there's a lot of emphasis on for your eyes and for your ears on doors being locked and unlocked. And one reason why that's such a crucial motif isn't just that the vote needs to be in secrecy, and of course we're inside the door, fortunately, we can be privy to that, but the fact that this is a film in which virtually everybody has a secret. I mean, it's sort of a Roman Catholic twist on I've got a secret. It's like, well, what about you? You've been a cardinal for years, but guess what? Here's a skeleton in your closet. And the thing is, it's borderline ridiculous at times that way, but some people cynically say, well, all politicians are like that. They've all got secrets in the closet. So that's actually also a preface of sorts by way of it's easy to talk about this film, but guardrails. We've got to be careful not to have any spoilers at all. And there's some really big spoilers as it goes along. So let me just sum up the long-winded preface, but by saying that the film itself is really entertaining. It's just really engaging, and it's truly an audience. And I saw it with a large audience. I was hosting a screening of it and saw it with a large audience, and it made such a difference to have that audible response from people, occasional actual gasps and people saying things out loud. It was something they hadn't expected in the film. And I love that because it gives you a sense of the communal experience. I'll turn it over to you, Marie. And I think it's actually so fitting today that you have a lot of red in the background as we zoom each other here, because I think almost all the costumes in this film are red. So with that, I turn it back to you.
Yeah, a lot of red and a lot of black and white. Very visually exciting. And I'm with you. I really think this is a spectacular movie. This is what they mean when they say they don't make movies like this anymore. Something for thinking people to observe, seeing behind doors that you're, not meant to know what's going on, that sense of intrigue and skullduggery and, backroom deals and things like that. All that stuff is great. And kind of like with the 2011 movie, We Have a Pope, where we had that. Every single seat was filled. I was in a very full theater. And I had seen two other movies that day. I'd seen Venom and the other movie we're going to talk about today, We Live in Time. And those two movies, I was all by myself. And by the time I got to Conclave, I was shocked to walk in and see a full audience. And like you said, it made for such a good experience. You could hear people gasping, like you said, talking amongst themselves at a couple of times. But one thing I found very wonderful about this movie, and I'm with you with both of those Academy Award nominations, if anybody's out there listening, Ralph Fiennes, he plays that role with this overwhelming sense of obedience and quiet, contemplative, wanting to do the right thing. He just hits that note just right. But there's so many other great people in it, like Stanley Tucci and John Lithgow. Some parts of what make it fun is when you're following up on, like, you just saw a part of a secret being revealed, and you can't wait to get back to that character to see what's going to happen. So I think the casting on this was just really, really spot on.
Well, for this as a papal thriller, you mentioned it as a thinking person's film. I think even an unthinking person can appreciate this film and enjoy it. And what I'm getting at there is it hits some primal notes there. Like the moment you see somebody in a position of power, as all these cardinals are, and indeed the Ralph Fiennes character, he's the dean of the college, if you will, and certainly an upstanding character, or we assume so. But some of the others we kind of assume must be villainous. But what I'm getting at there is, almost any audience member, I think, would be hooked on this because you're introduced to this closed circle of people with tremendous power, and they're taking not just a vote, but it's ballot after ballot. They've got to, agree on who the next pope's going to be. And that just sort of gets you pulled into the intrigue, and it's really kind of exciting at that level. And I would also mention another, this film's based on a book, but films like this oftentimes are, but go back to like Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. That's a case where whether you're Roman or Catholic or not, it doesn't matter whether you're religious at all, whatever, you get hooked on the mystery and the intrigue. And not that the religion's just an excuse, it's a very important setting. And indeed, you can't go wrong with the Vatican. And here they recreate the Vatican on a Cinecittà soundstage very effectively for the Sistine Chapel. So all that is like, if I say eye candy, I'm not saying in a dismissive way at all. It's really a pleasure to just to see the film there. And I think those are things that pull in any audience. The fact that, we're all intrigued by human nature and just how we're less than perfect in all sorts of ways. And also we just simply enjoy what I call visual pleasure, just simply having those wonderful costumes. And I always say that, myself as an Italian Roman Catholic, we have the best wardrobe. I mean, not saying anything against any other religion, but we have the best costumes. And so to see all those costumes on display is really splendid. And again, this is where, like, for instance, think about when a pope is elected, or think about when, a pope dies, any of those major events, the world is riveted. And this is a lot of non-Catholics. You want to see the ceremonies, you want to see that splendor in St. Peter's Square and so on. And that relates to the final thing I'll say at the moment, which is one thing that I think that hooks any audience is, we have some interest in, well, what's the process? How do they vote? I mean, we've been going through a presidential election, and so people wonder, how do they vote there? So inside the Sistine Chapel, and what I did like about the film is, among other, it's a procedural, and again, think like police procedural. This is a College of Cardinals procedural. How do they handle the vote? All the minutiae of it. And for instance, we're all familiar with that image from outside the church, if you will, standing in the square waiting for the smoke to rise. Will it be black smoke or white smoke? Here, though, you get to see that, but here you also get to see on the inside, there's got to be a guy, a bureaucrat, a technocrat who sits at a desk and knows which button to press so you know which color smoke you're going to get. I love details like that. I learn things from, and I think, well, if I ever, look to change jobs, that could be a job. And now I have a new skill set for setting up the right color smoke.
So that's your next gig. You're going to be smoke dude.
I guess so. Didn't you find that interesting in the film? I mean, it's
I
incidental to the
yes.
story per se, but isn't that fascinating sometimes, just those details?
I think that's actually one of the great strengths of it because it does bring you into this, very exact world. I mean, even when they close off the apartment where the Pope has, been removed, and they show you all of that, zipping up the body bag and, removing the body, and they take the ring off his finger and they melt it down, and then they close the door and there's this crimson ribbon and they seal it with, the papal stamp. I mean, it's this whole pomp and circumstance. And you're right, the costuming, especially the hats, are just spectacular.
Well, what's funny about that scene where the papal apartment is sealed off? because I was hosting a screening for it, there was an audience Q&A, and somebody made a logical, not quite objection, but just observation afterwards, like, well, okay, the Pope has died, and they've got to seal off the apartment and so on. And the way they do it is essentially ceremonial, because they put the ribbon and I call it the wax seal, whatever, they do all the official hullabaloo that way. And yet, when one of the cardinals later on wants to get into that apartment, all you got to do basically is open the door and walk in. And it was a logical observation verging on objection there that, well, wouldn't they? And I thought, wouldn't they at least have like a Swiss guard standing there by the door? But joking aside, the observation I made back during that Q&A was, well, you know what? These are primarily like everyone is a cardinal or in the cardinal's orbit, if you will. And the way that door is sealed at the papal apartment, to break that seal amounts to a sin. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know how it actually reads in canon law, but like this is the real official closure of the door, so you don't open it lightly. And that's another indication of detail here. Like, yeah, she could actually put a good padlock on it. There are things you could do. But, again, we're in a different world here. And Marie observed this a few minutes ago that, the rules of the game, how are things handled inside the Vat, deep inside the Vatican? And I love that. Now, one other reservation you could have about the film is, there's no shortage of intrigue at the Vatican, whether it's the Vatican Bank or any number of other things. And the film occasionally will allude to things like that. It's not going deep, you know what I mean? And I have nothing against surface pleasure, because I have so many films that don't provide any pleasure at all. So I'm all for surface pleasure. And let me ask you about that strand there, in that there's a lot of human venality and some suggestions of what all is going on at the Vatican, but it's not that kind of investigative film. It's not going to go deep on any one of these matters. I think it just sort of touches lightly on them. And that's not a complaint on my part, just an observation. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Also, in terms of the, I mean, it's not really sealing the door at all, and they don't have a guard. I mean, obviously it's the honor system, and if you cannot trust, the cardinals, I mean, who can you trust, right? But that's actually kind of visually sort of setting you up for the fact that everything is kind of on the honor system, and which one of the cardinals are on the up and up? Which of the gossipy stories are true or will pan out to mean something? In terms of it being gossipy, though, I'd say it's good trash. But you're right, it does kind of sit at, it does not really go that deep. I think that maybe the but then on the other hand, it's adapted from a book, so you're kind of constricted by what the story actually is, aren't you? Even though they
Well,
changed the
yes,
name
and
of the Ralph Fiennes character.
yes and no. I mean, in terms of literary adaptations, there's some, and I have not read the book. Since I'm in confession now, I'll confess that I haven't read the book. I haven't read the book. Okay, I've read about it, but haven't read it. So there you go. But in any event, in terms of literary adaptations, sometimes there are source novels that I would call like sacred text. Like if you tamper with it, at your own peril. There are other books where my basic response is, who cares? It's source material. Take it, do what you want with it. Maybe you just want the title and then do what you want with it. So I don't think you have any real obligation in that respect here. So I don't think that, for me at least, that wouldn't be an issue if you wanted to totally transform something as it is on the page to how it would be on the screen. Because after all, it's usually a mistake to be too faithful to, you're in a different medium and you have to make adjustments and changes. And so, generally speaking, I have no problem with that whatsoever.
There was also some moments that I thought were just sort of fun, where you saw these cardinals just doing normal people things, like trying to get in that last smoke before you have to go in and be sequestered, and going through airport checks and scrolling on their phones. It was sort of fun to see that, and then contrast that with the sort of inside baseball of what goes on in the conclave.
Speaking of the cigarettes, yes, a lot more of them smoke than you would expect, but one of the advantages of the smoking, if I can put it that way, is this is very much an inside movie, as we've been saying, a locked door and you're on the inside. But when they take a break or when they're waiting to go into a meeting, there are, of course, interior courtyards. And that's where the film visually plays some really interesting, what I call inside-outside games that way, that occasionally from that claustrophobia, even if it's a Sistine Chapel closed in like that, to be able to go out into a courtyard. And there actually are scripted references in the dialogue to like that, well, a breath of fresh air type dialogue to be able to be outside. And then without spoiling anything at the end of the film, the significance of doors opening and closing, who's coming, who's going, and so on. And it's not just a matter of among the cardinals themselves, but also gender factors in. Because, you know, it's an all-male clergy, of course, but a lot of the support staff would be the nuns who are, you know, whether it's serving a meal or carrying a message or what have you, being careful not to ruin anything here. But, you know, where a nun will say, well, we're supposed to be invisible, but we have eyes and ears. We hear things. And there's a degree of feminine assertion there that's really quite powerful, I think, within the film. Even though I just said it's surface pleasure, there's some serious issues percolating here. And I love the way things like that are handled, because sometimes the film can be quite subtle. And in some ways, it sort of bludgeons you over the head, but there are other things can be quite subtle sometimes. If you see the men in the foreground in their papal, in their cardinal robes, arguing and gossiping, you know, well, 10 feet in the background, there's a nun walking by carrying a tray, and she's got eyes, she's got ears, she's picking up on some of this. And that will actually factor into the story in a significant way. So it's actually carefully constructed. And that's part of the inside outside thing in terms of where people are placed inside the Vatican and when you can go out for a cigarette break, which actually cigarettes are healthy in that respect. It takes you outside of the meeting and out into the courtyard. But what do the guys do? They still gossip out there. So they're like anyone else. What's the trash talk? And actually for viewers, again, whether thinking or unthinking, it really holds you, because you think, well, you hear all these stories because they're telling stories about each other. Well, what can you trust? Like people, there are a lot of power plays here. Who really wants to be Pope? And all these voting coalitions, you know, I'll back you. And it's almost like Italian politics outside of the Vatican, where you have all these different political parties jousting for power. And no one party has enough power to simply claim the prize. But you have collaborations. Well, like if you give me your vote, I'll do this for you. And it's horse trading. And here you have what amount to political parties inside the Vatican. Now, what are the parties? Well, not formally speaking, but in terms of, you know, give me your vote and I'll do this for you, blah, blah, blah. You have a liberal wing, if you will. You also have a very conservative wing. There's one of the cardinals who would like to be Pope, actually, but who wants to see a return of the old Latin Mass, the Tridentine Mass, who's so conservative, he wants to go back to when we used Latin before. We'd be doing the show in Latin if he had his way. And so you get those, and that's a very real argument inside the church today between the more liberal wing and that arch conservative wing. And I love watching scenes where that plays out in their conversational exchanges. And that's part of the horse trading. It's just like, okay, well, you know, I want to be Pope. And so give me your vote. And then I can do this or that for you. And, you know, people are making deals. That's what it is. I don't know how God looking down feels about this, but here down on earth, people are making deals. It's how sausage is made. You don't really want to see that process, but then again, you do.
Well, there's something that they say in the movie about only those who don't seek power deserve to have it. That's sort of an interesting thread in the movie. And, you know, they talk a little bit about doubt. And one thing I thought they also did really well is the very beginning when the Pope has died, they kind of explore a little bit the personal relationships he had with some of the people around him. I mean, there were people really devastated that they'd lost this friend. Anyway, by the time you get to the part where they're gossiping and they're doing all these deals and stuff, breaking the rules is just fun to watch. But we need to move on to our second film, which is called We Live in Time. So I have to say, you know, I was so excited about seeing this movie because I love these two leads, Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh, and they are the best thing about it. I'm going to start off by saying that I love this movie and I highly recommend it, but it has serious problems. And the first problem.
I want to focus on the serious problems. Do you want to go first or should I go first?
The first serious problem is that it's told non-linearly. And I was so lost. I mean, I was just trying to figure out where are we? And until she changes her hair in, you know, various time periods, completely lost. That's the first problem.
That is the major problem in the film. It has a non-chronological structure. There are three time periods involving a relationship between the characters played by Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield. And the thing is, as it jumps around, and boy, does it jump around from one period to another, it's slightly confusing much of the way through. And it can often take you a minute or two to realize where you are, to get grounded. And the way you finally do that is changes in hairstyle, clothing, degree of pregnancy, anything that might sort of indicate where you are. That is so distracting. It really lifts you out of the story because you feel like, I felt like, well, am I the village idiot? Like, I don't, where am I right now? And it takes me a minute or two. And then just as I'm getting caught up, it jumps to some other time period. That's irritating after a while. But what makes it incredibly irritating, actually, is that nothing is gained from a thematic perspective. I have no deeper understanding of these characters or of underlying issues, personal background, yada yada. None of that. And in fact, when I was hosting it for a screening, people kept saying that in the audience. They said, like, we didn't learn anything new or different because of this. We just got confused by it. And I think that's a fatal flaw in the film. A second major problem I would point to, because I really didn't like the film, and a second major flaw would be that the Florence Pugh character, she's a cook. She's going to get cancer. So there's a lot going on in her life, and there's some reservations about how she's treated as a suffering woman within the script. And that's a whole other. We go on for 5 hours about that in terms of what the male directors and screenwriters do with such characters. But that's sort of like an extended discussion. But what's the fatal flaw in that respect is, her character is fairly well developed. Whatever the flaws might be in the scripted logic and in the male gaze at such a character, blah, blah, she's got presence on screen. However, the Andrew Garfield character, and so many people just before the screening were saying, oh, they love Andrew Garfield. He's such a sweetheart. They want to marry him, this and that. And well, after seeing his film, I don't know if you want to marry him, but within the film, his role is so underwritten. She's the cook, as I say. He actually works for a cereal company. He's as bland and as anonymous almost. As I referred to him as an attractive cipher. You don't really get to know him that much as a character. It's a really underwritten role. And what happens is they end up going, and it's no knock against him as an actor, but what they do in the filmmaking is there are many close-up shots, reactive shots, not just of his face, but of his weeping eyes, because this is a weepy, this film. Bring your tissues. And that to me was like, that's asking a lot of us. Like, every time we should be getting some dialogue, some background on him, some insight. What do? We get a close-up of his eyes and they're moist. Well, my eyes weren't moist at that point. I was turning the movie off. And then it's also really, so a third major knock from my perspective is it can be incredibly heavy-handed at times. Without belaboring the specific symbolism here, because we'd have to get into all kinds of specifics of story and incident and so on, there are a lot of eggs in this movie. Some are fertilized and some not. And so we can relate that to, pregnancy cycles and yada yada. But the thing is, like, sometimes you have a scene like that where if somebody holds up, a dozen eggs, I think, oh no, we got more eggs here. And so the film sometimes just sort of, I would never throw eggs at a screen. That's for Rocky Horror Picture Show. But there were places where I was like really losing patience with it, the way it clubs us with that. So I found the film actually very disappointing. And yet you're right, Marie, it has two actors that we really enjoy watching, and they made it watchable. Let's put it that way.
Oh, I just think in so many ways this film should have been so much better because I thought, for example, it had the right amount of humor. I thought the dialogue between the characters was good. The fights they had felt real. But some things were just unforgivably misses, like the fact that Andrew Garfield supposedly worked at like Weetabix or something. It had absolutely nothing to do with the story at all. And you never saw him at work. It was underwritten, I mean, to the max. The second thing that I really thought was a real problem, just in terms of suspending disbelief, who leaves a hotel to go buy some pens in a bathrobe?
Yeah, I
Walking down
know.
the street, crossing a bridge in a
That's
bathrobe.
that scene made me so
Ridiculous.
angry. It made me so angry because it was so unnecessary. Like, it would have been so easy, like, put on your pants kind of moment, right? But it's just, I suppose it was meant to be amusing or, visually clever or something. But the whole time I watched it, I thought, what a fool. I mean, it seemed like really stupid behavior. And whatever sympathy I had for these characters, and you should at certain points in the storyline, I thought, come on now. I mean, this is like they thought, well, wouldn't you can imagine, like, on the set, somebody saying, well, what if you just go out the door in a bathrobe? Like, I thought, well, what are the situations, unless there's like a 5-alarm fire at the hotel and you have to flee all at once, what are the situations where you would actually do that? And Marie, that was like the single most irritating scene in the whole film. And I never got over that. I thought, this is so dumb.
It's so dumb. So dumb. Now, it is trying to make you think, don't think about the future. All you have is now. It tries to make a case for this. In fact, Florence Pugh's character makes a case for this. And then there is no follow-up for that whole, the fallout of what that meant and how it affected Andrew Garfield. It just like completely like fell off the radar of the entire story.
Now, I don't want to do armchair psychoanalysis on that, but at the risk of doing so, it seems to me that when they decided to go with the nonlinear structure, initially heading into it, that might seem like a good idea because some films have done that before and it can work well. But I think what happens is once you get locked into that, they just like barreled ahead. You know what I'm getting at? It's like there wasn't the further thought process, as if they were all just still wearing their bathrobes as they sat around the conference table. It's just like it's like conceptually that might have worked, but then on the follow through, it's like, well, they've locked into it, and now that's how they're going to do it. And at that level, they probably pat themselves on the back, like, well, okay, she's got the appropriate hairstyle for this scene. You know what I mean? And then you can go home happy that day from work, right? Because you're in the film crew and you gave her the right hairdo. And it seems to me that they somehow stop thinking at a certain point as to, well, how's this going to play? How does it make sense? Does it take us deeper into character? So yeah, I think the film's from my perspective, a total misfire.
What did you think about the scene in the gas station? In particular, I thought that the two characters who worked at the gas station had great roles in that moment, in that whole scene. They really, like, you felt like you kind of knew something about them by the time the scene was over.
Well, ironically, I knew, yes, the incidental pleasure in that scene, they really are fun to watch. And ironically, I felt like I knew them better than I knew Andrew Garfield's character. I wanted the story to go off on a tangent. Let's have it be about not a guy who works for a cereal company, but guys who work at a gas station.
Actually, that what I found interesting about that scene is because of the way the story was told all out of order, it felt like that, they say at the end of your life flashes before your eyes. This was more like their life was flashing before your eyes. So that's why I thought the gas station scene worked, because for a moment you were those two people working there, kind of observing this couple that you had seen do other things.
Good
That I think
point.
for some reason that actually really worked. And I want to say something about the director too, because I looked him up and I watched Boy A, which is, I think, Andrew Garfield's first movie. So he had directed him before. And that movie was a gut punch. That's a really interesting movie, although I
Yeah, it
think the
is.
ending is kind of shocking.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a solid film. And so, yeah, that's one reason why I expected better from this one, because they certainly, he's done, he did good work there, sure.
So I guess we're saying life is short, and I'm saying go see this movie anyway, because the chemistry between the two leads is spectacular. Even though, like I said, it has real problems, I really, really liked this movie. And you're
Yeah,
saying
but.
don't go see this movie.
Well, and for that reason, even with the gas station scene, I found myself thinking, I need to get gas today, So life is short, and we got to live in the now, and this is what I need to do now.
Okay, well, that does bring us to the end of our episode, but don't forget to check out our other podcasts at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.